Have you heard about the official sponsor of the London Lyceum and Hanover Press? It's Professor Lending, your premier home financing guide, helping you not only purchase a home, but steward it well for you, your family, and your future. Founded by me, Jordan Stefaniak, and staffed by local church leaders, we exist to bring clarity and trust back into the lending process. Home financing can feel confusing, oftentimes sketchy, and that's why we're here, to offer integrity, transparency, education, and excellent service. Too often, there is zero education in the mortgage process, and you're left completely hanging, and that's not right. That's why you should check us out at ProfessorLending.com. That is ProfessorLending.com. Whether you're a first-time buyer, working with a unique property like a farm, or a builder needing liquidity, or even an investor looking to expand your portfolio, we have solutions tailored for you. So check us out. Professor Lending, financing with integrity for families who care about their future. London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And thinking seriously, we've endeavored to create or cultivate an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, cheerful confessionalism. So if you're brand new to the show, we talk to a lot of people. And some people you'll be familiar with, some you won't, some you'll like, some you won't. And it's part of the fun of learning new things and exploring and building friendships and relationships and understanding different topics and ideas. We think it's important to hear from people we agree with and those we disagree with, and people who know a lot about stuff that we have no idea about. And it's fun. So we talk philosophy, history, theology, everything in between. And today I've got Dr. Paul Sanchez with me. Dr. Sanchez has been with us in the past, so we talked, I don't know, it's been years ago now, the first time on William Poteet. Then we talked on, I think, theological liberalism, on the history of that at one point.
We did one on Pentecostalism as well. Which
That's right. Yeah, Pentecostalism. That's the one that was in my mind where we had done an interview on Pentecostalism, and it was an interesting one. Which led us to that. Now we've got Paul's book, New Christianity for the New South, with the University of South Carolina Press. We're going to talk about it and related topics to it. But before we get started, Paul, remind us, where are you located now? What do you primarily do and teach? And what's of interest in those areas?
Yeah, I'm at Oklahoma Baptist University, which has been in Shawnee, Oklahoma since 1910, just a few years after Oklahoma became a state. I really love it here. I get to teach a variety of subjects, from great books and things in sort of the classical world to things like Baptist history and theology and an intro to theology and ethics course. It's really primarily undergrads that I work with, almost exclusively undergrads for that matter. And I've been here for 4 years, going on my fifth year, and it's really been a great experience. Love it here.
You know, it would be the historian in you to know exactly when your school was founded and be able to recall that so quickly, you just did that all the time off the cuff.
Yeah. It's important, yeah.
So, to give me some context on the book in particular, I know this was a long time coming, and I'm curious, what were the biggest changes that you made? I mean, you've been researching and thinking about this for a long time. From inception to this, to say when I first started on this in my dissertation to when it's actually a book, what are the major changes that you're making?
Yeah, it has been. It's weird for me to think about. It's been almost a decade since I've been working on this. Here more recently, I'm moving on to some different things. But yeah, I mean, better part of a decade. And so in the beginning, it's a topic that interests me and was a shift in terms of what I wanted to focus on for my dissertation. But very much jumped into that world of theological liberalism and the Baptist in Southern cultural context, especially. And so spent, you know, a lot of time delving into that. As the dissertation itself came to fruition in kind of the late 2010s, in leading up to be finished in 2020, I, you know, had thoughts of wanting to publish it and what that would look like, but really wasn't sure what would need to change. Even just a lot of times it's stylistic things and things like that. But going through the process of the dissertation itself and then actually getting feedback from an outside reader as well as from the other readers, I had kind of a whole list of things that I would have wanted to do, had I, you know, put it up for revision and that sort of thing. And so, I just got a tremendous amount of feedback. So sometimes that feedback is not helpful. It's like contradictory and it's different people wanting to know everything, but all of it at the end of the day, in my case, ended up being very helpful. And so part of it was a substantial reorganization, really putting it into a more consistent narrative, whereas it was, as a dissertation, a set of more topics and was heavily theological. I wanted to preserve the theological elements. I didn't want to lose that at all. But putting it into kind of a thorough kind of what I hope is a kind of readable and smoother narrative. So that took some time. It took some, there were plenty of things that I cut out and removed, and there were plenty of things that I had to fill out and smooth. And then, of course, in that time, there's a few things that came out, some articles and a book that came out that I wanted to make sure to incorporate. And so I'm updating and I'm refining some different things. Refining the argument was really important, which that's probably where my feedback was most helpful, was refining what exactly I'm trying to say, what it is I'm most interested in, always wanting to kind of point to more contemporary application without, on one hand, without exploring it explicitly, because this, you know, book, I want to keep it short. I want to keep it, you know, within a certain time frame. But also not wanting to be preachy and not wanting it to be something other than what it is, right? It's a historical monograph. It's not a book about ministry. It's not a book about even ecclesiology and that sort of thing. And so trying to find some ways to kind of put it into that format, you know, took, you know, goodness, quite a bit of time. And then I submitted it kind of together in what would really be a new manuscript, refined, reorganized, expanded, nuanced to a couple people, and got even more feedback. It's one of those things where, like, I wonder how long this could go on, like, in terms of the feedback that I get and I go through it. But it was tremendously helpful. The feedback I got in this sort of second phase was from people that are not really in the theological world, that are not really in my tribe theologically. And so they just brought a different lens and a different posture toward it. And that was extremely helpful. So I was able to incorporate quite a bit of that. It's one of those things where I could have feasibly kept going on, you know, for a much longer time. But then I finally got to the point, okay, where do I want to publish this? What would be a good publisher? It's a historical monograph. I don't expect, you know, that it's going to sell, even if it's a pretty decent work, which I think it's a good work. I don't expect it's going to sell big, but I want it to be with a publisher that I hoped could market it, that would kind of get it. So I was thinking something within the South, right? Somewhere kind of within the Southern sphere, connected with some very different people. And the University of South Carolina Press, I was impressed with them and some of the insights they were able to offer. And then just the staff, as I got to know them, I really had a great entire process with them. In fact, once I connected with them, things started moving forward very quickly. Just within the last, I don't know, last year or something like that. You don't quote me on that, but more or less something like that. And so it's been a process where I mean, there were times where I didn't work on it for a few months, but more or less, I mean, it's been something that I have been chipping away at, and then at times, sometimes working on it quite substantially over the last few years or so. But now altogether, yeah, close to a decade that this has been something I've thought about, wanted to refine, and certainly could go on and do much more with, but I'm, you know, kind of pointing some different directions now with some of my scholarly interests.
Yeah, I mean, I think the topic is extremely relevant today and seems to be, in my mind, a cycle that seems to repeat itself fairly often. And so being able to have resources from the past to help think through challenges that we just seem to continue to engage in various, I don't know, different ways, it can be helpful. So maybe sketch out the general argument that you have in the book in like mini scope, at least to start.
Yeah. So again, with this kind of, you know, wanting to have a narrative, I mean, I'm kind of trying to tell the story how one prominent Southern liberal or progressive theological thinker, religionist, comes to his conclusions. And so my argument is kind of, what is it that leads him to embrace these ideas? What is it, knowing that all humans are different, and yet there is it, to your exact point, there does seem to be these trends, there does seem to be these things that play out again and again. So trying to get into kind of his mind and what is it that leads him to adopt these ideas, having come from a very traditional, generic Southern evangelical background as a Southern Baptist in North Carolina, that was his world. How did he get to the point that he was in? And so I look closely at things like social class, things like education, which is really, really significant. And then just his location, his kind of cultural ecosystem in a New South state that is rapidly changing in the late 19th and into the early 20th century. And so I was curious about kind of what are these conditions that leads to this, as well as his own kind of individual struggle, like what was it? And at the end of the day, I think it's kind of each of those things. I do think that he himself has some unique intellectual kind of grappling that he's going through. Puts it forward as kind of an intellectual crisis that comes out of his time as a professor at Wake Forest College as a very young professor and kind of entering the profession in the 1870s and into the 1880s. And so part of it is his own wrestlings, but really I think the broader thing is much of it is tied to this new social class. I mean, I'm using language that other historians have used as sort of a Southern bourgeoisie, this culture that is very heavy upon refinement and pious respectability, and this ascent of this new kind of middle class in the very post Civil War South. So I think that has a huge thing to do with it. And then just education, right? It, on one hand, it's not even institutionally specific. So it's not that if you go to Mercer or if you go to Wake Forest or if you go to Baylor that you therefore adopt these ideas, but it's something within the educational kind of air of the time that, again, doesn't mean that everyone is going to adopt these ideas. There are plenty who don't, but it's sort of the conditions are there. And so I think that's a crucial part of this. And so I go quite in depth into the educational part of it. And then again, just the kind of the air that he's breathing in this new South culture, which is something, it's an era that historians, do a lot of work in. It's not something that theologians would necessarily really know about, but kind of capital N, capital S, New South. It's not something that's everywhere, but it's in key cities. So it is in places like Raleigh and Chapel Hill and Asheville. And then outside of North Carolina, it's in places like Nashville and Birmingham and Atlanta a lot, especially in places like Atlanta, but not at all in places like New Orleans and Mobile and Charleston. Those places are old South cities in significant measure. And so you don't see a lot of that coming out of there. And so I think his placement in kind of the New South world, which is in the title, of course, is really significant to shaping these ideas. Again, not in like deterministic way, not that he would have to adopt these ideas, but it kind of seems to be this path that leads him there. I could say more about sort of what other historians have talked about as kind of a professional identity crisis, or kind of a social, honestly kind of an insecurity, a professional anxiety in this new world, wanting to preserve a place of significance and respectability in this changing world, basically preserving a place for religion and for Christianity specifically in this world that is moving toward, if not a more secular place, certainly just a place where religion is less prominent. Even in a place like the South that we think of as a very conservative society. And so I think that plays into it. And again, other historians have worked on that, so that's not entirely novel, but I think it's absolutely what I see within Petit himself. So again, my argument is basically kind of tracing those key things that I think are the factors that lead him there. And then I'm looking at other figures that either slightly complicate the picture, like maybe they don't adopt these ideas, but really more often than not, I'm looking at several people that seem to kind of go along with him in kind of this same stream, really toward creating what I kind of consider this kind of liberal stream within Southern Baptist life and in American church life.
Yeah. So talk to me more about the New South in particular. What's the difference between that and the Old South? And then how did it really come to be?
Yeah. So after the Civil War, the South is in just utter destitution. The economy has collapsed, with everything having been based on chattel slavery. That's collapsed. And they're under military occupation, literally, close to a generation, not quite a generation, but for quite a few years, until the later 1870s. And it's a time of, again, sort of disillusionment. I mean, literally sort of this emerging nationality comes to a halt in 1865. The South is depressed in kind of just every way. And so the New South comes along, especially trumpeted and championed by people like Henry Grady, who was a newspaper editor at the Atlanta Constitution. So Henry Grady and several others, but he's the real name identified with this, kind of begin articulating this vision for a South that is more or less modeled off of what the North has been doing for two generations. And so it's seeking to embrace industrialism, which had not reached the South. The South was still a strongly agricultural society. It really looked more like a feudalistic society of medieval Europe than it did the modern world in some ways in terms of its economy. I mean, so it's embracing industry. It's embracing, honestly, just a more progressive outlook, lowercase p, right? Just a forward thinking, rather than one looking toward tradition and Southern ways of things, it's looking toward the future. They remain very Southern culturally. So it's not as if the people who embrace this New South spirit are, antagonistic toward their Southern roots. They're very Southern still culturally. But rather than kind of lingering there and rather than kind of looking backward for what ultimately should shape their future, they're really looking toward primarily the North. So they're seeking investment from Northern commercial interests and as well as from Europe. And so it's really the age where the South goes through its own industrial revolution. Places that had been very small or literally actually so small that they don't even occur on a map all of a sudden overnight become major cities. So that's places like Birmingham. That's places like, I'm drawing a blank. It's in the research triangle just west of Chapel Hill, but several different places there. This is true of Asheville, North Carolina. Atlanta had been a city, but it becomes a grand city. Charlotte, North Carolina. Is one. Nashville, as I mentioned, but it's not, this is not going to occur in places like Mississippi and in places like Arkansas. It's very, very limited that it'll be in places like this. And in South Carolina, the only place we see some of this in South Carolina is in the very kind of upstate region. And so whereas much of the rest of South Carolina really in many ways retains this old South flavor, the old South flavor is one that is, again, really trying to preserve a more agricultural orientation that resists industry, that resists Northern investment. It's not that they're sort of more unreconstructed, if you will, to use Southern language, but they just simply are not interested in sort of the revolution going on around them. Sometimes it comes their way, even if they're reluctant. For instance, the timber industry will come down and clear forests in Mississippi and places like this. But in terms of the local people benefiting from this and embracing this idea, it is kind of isolated to key cities. And so in those cities, those tend to become, and even to this day, those are the places in the South where, again, they become major cities, they gain influence, and they kind of re-enter the sort of national American life. Whereas before that, the South is so isolated, so removed. All of a sudden, the South is again kind of re-entering into kind of the mainstream of American life.
That's super interesting. So Poteet's own background, remind me, where does he grow up and how is he getting introduced to a lot of the ideas that are shaping him?
So he is born and raised in the Piedmont region of North Carolina. His family, they are among the leading planter families in the Piedmont. Now, saying that, so they're not, you know, they're not the grand plantation owners that you would see further down in South Carolina or in the lower Mississippi River Valley. But within North Carolina, within the Piedmont region, they are a very affluent family. And so he has this old South background, as most of the New South guys did. And he fits the age just perfectly because he's coming of age as the New South is rising in the 1870s and primarily 1880s. So he fits into that. But again, his ideas were shaped by his very conservative, traditional Southern Baptist church in Yanceyville, North Carolina, very, very small community even to this day. And his family is able to make a transition into kind of, again, this post-Civil War era. So again, their plantation is gone, their slaves are gone, their wealth is largely gone, but they're able to basically become, again, sort of this middle-class, industrious, business-owning, entrepreneurial type family. And each of their kids go on to be significant educators. So obviously, William Lewis Poteet becomes professor and then president at Wake Forest College. Their other son, Edward McNeil Poteet, becomes president at Furman University. And then their sister, Ida Poteet, becomes chair of the art department at Meredith College. And so each of their kids are kind of, again, in this. So the progress, thinking forward, they are very, not only pro-education, but they themselves are contributing to society, trying to enlighten the Southern mind, trying to bring progress to the South, along with a whole lot of other ways they're involved. And so that's a huge part of the story here.
You have a whole chapter on the modern culture of refinement and pious respectability. And I'm curious, how does that differ from previous generations or different eras to what we experience today?
Yeah, that's a great question. So he is really coming to age in kind of this late Victorian era. The Victorian era we usually think of as something that's, you know, primarily in England, but it absolutely has an impact in American culture in the late 19th century. And Poteet is going to kind of carry this into the early 20th century. Sometimes we would cut off the Victorian age around 1900 or so. And so the way that the Victorian world is going to impact this is kind of in part a set of sensibilities. So it's less intellectual. I guess primarily what I would say is it's a set of sensibilities that emphasizes things like domesticity and again, refinement, like you said, and education and all of these sort of things that are kind of this polite, well-ordered, middle-class domestic life that I think oftentimes we think of as sort of, giving sort of a vision for the early 20th century America, because again, that's kind of flowing into that. And so he is in many ways the picture that even just visibly sort of a certain way that their dress kind of fits in this certain thing. He fits it kind of to a T. And so it's not that this is going to affect him in terms of adopting a certain philosophy. He's getting that from the German idealists and from other intellectual thinkers, primarily in Europe, and some Americans like Josiah Royce. But he's getting, but in terms of how he sees the world and what he values, it in many ways fits this sort of Victorian mold.
So we've got these sensibilities that are in the water here at this time. It seems to me, in our current climate, we also have these sensibilities in segmented groups, and there's large groups that now want to sort of push back on these and say these are, I don't know, post-war consensus sensibilities, whatever you want to call them. Is there a similar sort of fight over, are these useful? Are these good? Should we actually prize these things in this period as there are now?
That's such an interesting question. I mean, on one hand, just the point you're making, I think, is important that every age kind of has its own sensibilities, right? What drives it, what people value, that sort of thing, how they see the world and that sort of thing. I mean, it's more than worldview. It's like worldview applied, like in some ways. No, it doesn't seem to be that at this time, right? In the late 19th century into the early 20th century, you really don't even, it's something that's so subtle and subconscious that people aren't so much talking about it. Part of this is sort of historians looking back and reflecting on what was kind of just like you said, like kind of in the air or in the water. And so it was prevalent, especially in urban areas. So if you were in a more remote part of, I don't know, central Kentucky, you might not have, it might've been a different world, right? But in especially cities, in the middle class, these are kind of values and sentiments and sensibilities that people embraced. And it is kind of across America. So you'd see it on the West Coast, you'd see it in the South, you'd see it in the Northeast. But it's kind of demographic. It's a certain cross-section of the American, you know, landscape. And so it's, you don't so much see people arguing or disagreeing with it. Sometimes people poke fun at it. And so someone like the journalist Henry L. Mencken, you know, might point, poke fun at it, you know, or again, call it prudish or things like that. It's focus on the family and domesticity, for instance, or whatever it is. So you definitely have kind of cultural critics that kind of will poke fun at it and that sort of thing. But it just kind of, it's just sort of in the air, and it's not anything that people are advocating for so much. at least, again, not like consciously. It just seems to be something that they value in the same way that, I don't know, just off the top of my head, I think values that in our society would be things like tolerance and inclusivity and egalitarian spirit, like things like that, for instance. But even there, you might find less of that in rural Oklahoma than you would in, I don't know, St. Louis or San Francisco or wherever. And so, it was just kind of in the air, and it wasn't controversial as much as not everyone, working class people would be less likely to embrace it. For instance, the people in the Gilded Age, you know, sort of in higher classes are maybe less likely to focus on it so much. It's kind of class specific.
Yeah. So then talk to me again about the rise of the conservative opposition. That's right in the middle of the heart of the book. What's the thought process here? What are they thinking? How are they responding to all of this?
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting parts to me when I got into the research is, number one, that there's such a delay because these ideas are really developing and maturing throughout the last 20 years of the 19th century. And they go back earlier. I mean, of course, we know Crawford Toy was, you know, a generation before Petit in terms of his activity. Now, I guess really as Petit's in college, Toy is a professor and things like that. But you know, there's quite a bit of a generational gap there. And so it's not that these ideas are new once we get to the 20th century. They've been around a little bit. And part of what we see there is Petit and others, Alfred J. Dickinson and R.T. Vann and others are going to say things like, hey, we've believed this for a while. Like, why are you guys freaking out about this now? And so the opposition rise is really in the late 19 teens. So leading right up to 1920. But they really don't, they're not able to organize and they're not able to really form any kind of substantial opposition until the 1920s. And really it is around 1920 and then through 1922 and then kind of reaching a high water mark of opposition, 1925, 1926. And so it exists in very, very kind of minute form here or there throughout the 19 teens. But in only very, very small kind of an allusion to or a mention towards some theological, you know, concern or whatever it would be against this teacher or this pastor or whatever it would be. But it really forms together as a movement in the 1920s. And when it does really start taking off. And there's a time where it really looks like it could be that the fundamentalists will win, to use the language of Harry Emerson Fosdick. But of course, we know the longer story now, you know, in hindsight that, of course, the fundamentalists lose again, not only in the South and with Petit, but in America as a whole, they lose institutional strength. They're kind of relegated to kind of the margins of American cultural life. And that's in a sense what happens in the South and with Petit. But the difference is that Southern Baptists are able to, in part because just the sheer size and the cultural power of the grassroots, kind of, again, you know, the dominant part of Southern Baptist life, they're able to maintain a more conservative theological consensus in the pew, so to speak, within the grassroots world, even as from Petit. And again, this whole coalition of theological liberals or progressive thinking people around him that will eventually gain control over really all, with some few exceptions, of the educational institutions, from Baptist colleges and seminaries to key churches, key pulpits, ministries and things like that. So the grassroots kind of is able to maintain control of Southern Baptist life ostensibly, even as the leadership is moving toward throughout the mid 20th century. And then up until the latter part into the 1960s, 70s and 80s, which is the better story of the conservative clash in Southern Baptist life. There is this gradual movement toward, not full hegemony, but something really, really close to it. In Southern Baptist life, a control of the denominational entities, institutions, led by, again, these progressive or liberal thinkers.
So the institutional element is super interesting. I mean, the control and I guess the how that influences sort of more popular consensus is fascinating to me. What's going on here in this period? Like, is there a sense in which let's, you know, more conservative or more liberal are more prone to being understanding how to use institutions and lead institutions and ultimately effectively change for what they think is right?
Yeah. So the part of the rise of the fundamentalist movement, kind of nationally, but within the Southern Baptist life, is this recognition of, like you said, the power of institutions. Part of it just the sheer money that goes into these institutions. And they would begin using language like, that's Baptist money, by which they mean our Southern Baptist money, that is funding Wake Forest, or that is funding Southern Seminary in Louisville, or that is funding Mercer College in Georgia or Baylor in Texas. And so there is this greater awareness of this. And I don't know that the liberal thinkers are going to necessarily be ahead of the game on that. They just, again, are kind of enjoying leadership and enjoying the influence that they have. I don't think that they're trying to be crafty and gain control. I think that would be a misconception. I've not come across anything that would make me think that they were, from the 19th century into the 20th century, trying to gain denominational and institutional control. It's just happening. They again are kind of the leaders, just by virtue of being the educated ones, by virtue of being leaders in Southern society. The same is true in the North, I think. But ultimately what happens is the fundamentalists kind of eventually, the fundamentalist is a new term, but I think what you and I would understand, what listeners would understand, is fundamentalism, this kind of more organized, militant, approach to, conservative, evangelical, Protestant, ideas and tradition and so on. And as well as developing into its own thing, fundamentalism becomes its own tradition. But they become wise to having lost significant influence, or at the very least seeing kind of the writing on the wall that they were about to. And so that's part of the organization there. And it's this, in Southern Baptist life, we can kind of pinpoint a few specific things that lead to that. Part of it is this, what was called the 75 million campaign. I think I've got that number right. So the idea was that Southern Baptists would raise $75 million, a lot of money at the time, to fund all of their entities, to fund missions. And as they did that, they began seeing, wow, this is a lot of money. And this is kind of money that we want to see going to things that we would advocate and support. So they felt this sense of ownership. And so feeling a sense of ownership, they thought, we better do what we can to, at the very least, preserve, if not in some cases, try to regain later down the road, try to regain control over these institutions. And so thus the clash, because the conservatives are primarily, especially in places like North Carolina and places, several different educational institutions, they're kind of on the outside looking in. And so they're trying to gain control. But by this point, the progressives will kind of be on the defensive. And yet they do have the benefit of already leading many of the institutions.
Yeah, the whole dynamic, all of it, it's super interesting. It seems like, I don't know, some of these issues have never really been resolved.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, you've got chapters on evolution, and I feel like people are still talking about evolution. You know, there's still debates on this. Would you say the way they're engaging some of these topics are similar to how we're still fighting over some of this today, or there are significant dissimilarities?
I think there are some dissimilarities, but the similarities are striking. I mean, to your point, sometimes even down to things as similar as the very motions that are coming forward in a denominational meeting, for example, when it comes to who will choose trustees for institutions. So that was what ultimately the conservatives are trying to use to gain a longer term control or influence at Wake Forest University, is requiring that the denomination would select trustees. Those are the same sort of things that we heard in Baptist colleges all the way up until very, very recently, and very potentially could hear in the future. So who will control trustee boards, thus who will control the institutions in the long term? Some of the things that we're looking at today in terms of like just dissimilarities, some of ours are more cultural. Not to say that there's no theological relevance, but things like sexuality, things like gender, some political things, those would look more unique. That would have stood out in the early 20th century. Not that they didn't have political differences. Of course they do. I mean, goodness, I look into things like eugenics, which had very significant political resonances and political relevance. So there were some things that could be legal and political. But to them, it was more explicitly theological, at least early on. But to your point, the evolution thing, that does become, it's a long theme that continues or comes up, it's not consistent, but it comes up at various times throughout the 20th and into the 21st century. But in our time, it's charged in a different political way, probably just because our society as a whole has become much more secular. And whereas at this time, I mean, we shouldn't assume that, you know, the majority of Southerners are regenerate Christians as the way that an evangelical would recognize. But Christian society is far more Christian at this time, you know, because of just this broader Christian influence in American and Southern society. Whereas today, of course, that's changed substantially, even in the so-called Bible Belt, which is diminishing significantly kind of year by year, just statistically. So some of those things would look different. It's far more cultural today. And I guess one similarity would be that you tend to, when you're in the moment, when you're in the, whether it's, you know, your institution or whether it's your denominational meeting or whether it's a particular topic, you know, at the SBC or whatever it is, people tend to still have on both sides, whether 100 years ago or today, this feeling like everything is at stake. There is this urgency that if we get this wrong, everything is at stake. Whereas sometimes you look back and you're like, okay, not everything was at stake. But again, sometimes there are big things at stake. So I don't want to diminish that. In fact, sometimes what I say is if we make it as if the whole fate of the denomination or the whole fate of our churches and fellowship is at stake with every single issue, well, then really it's, you know, you kind of lose the seriousness when it is really at stake. But I'll leave that up to various people's opinions on each issue. But
you don't want to opine on them.
yeah, that's right.
So you mentioned, I think you've been working on this for over a decade, and your research is taking you in some other areas as well. What are those things that you're most interested in working on right now?
So I'm still interested in American culture. I'm still interested in theology. I'm still interested in the development of the church, but I've kind of shifted geographically. And this wasn't something that I planned. I just kind of just by happenstance found myself interested, and one book led to another, led to 10, led to a whole host of other things, and kind of entered kind of a new area. I still am very interested in the South and the Southern scene. And so there's times where my current work will dip back there, and where, again, in the future, I might do much more on Southern religion, on theological liberalism, things like that. But mostly what I'm working on now is shifted to the West Coast, the American West broadly, but especially the West Coast and especially California. And so a work I'm working on right now and hoping to finish this fall is a book called California Dreaming, Evangelical Christianity and American Culture in the Golden State, which is primarily a study of California cultural life and religious life in the 20th century. But it covers such a range of things. I mean, on one hand, it began, and the publisher was interested in it because it's supposed to be kind of surprising, not provocative, but just sort of surprising because we don't normally put California and evangelical Christianity together. But you begin digging into it, and so many of the key events of evangelical life over the last, you know, in the 20th century, but over the last 150 years have taken place in California. And so, I mean, that's, you know, and that's actually how I began really digging into this. So whether we're talking about the rise of Pentecostalism, happens in California, the rise of new evangelicalism, arguably with Fuller Seminary in California, the whole Dust Bowl and kind of Sunbelt Christianity that historians love talking about takes place in Southern California, the rise of Asian American evangelicalism in California. And so over and over, these sort of things, again, a more just the movement toward a more diverse and multi-ethnic evangelicalism that we see today, much of that emerges in California. And it didn't happen in the 1990s. I mean, really, it goes back much earlier. And so I'm looking at just a whole host of things there, kind of chronologically, and trying to see how these various religious movements are similar to what I was describing in the South with Poteet, how the cultural ecosystem and the political and all the other things that make kind of 20th century California what it is, how those things shape faith, how those things shape evangelicalism, but also how evangelicism has an impact in the kind of cultural landscape of California. So the Jesus People movement is a good example here. And then late 60s and early 1970s, it's there set in California, of course. That's where it all begins and emerges. And it has a significant impact on the cultural landscape there in ways that I think are not always appreciated. So I'm still interested in American culture. I'm still interested in, and especially I've broadened, so not just Baptist primarily, although even with my work in the South, I was looking at Presbyterians and Methodists. I was looking at some others, but now I'm really looking at the whole of evangelicalism. So I've got, again, Pentecostals and Baptists and Methodists and Bible churches and lots of weird alternative evangelical quasi folks like Bethel Church. And like, you know, so there's some interesting things, a whole range that allows me to look at the kind of religious landscape and how kind of faith and culture interact.
Yeah, well, we've got the pre-orders ready for that one.
I hope so. Yeah, soon.
I think we've got a number of those already ready to click the button who are listening.
Man, I hope
I think
so.
That's fascinating. So last word on this particular book that you finished up, that's out with, again, University of South Carolina Press. What would you say is your main hope that it accomplishes in the broader literature and just the community at large?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. A couple of things. I mean, on one hand, I hope, the thing that I found most interesting and that I hope would there be some light shined on this fact that there is this liberal tradition that arises. In other words, kind of the conflict that Southern Baptists come into in the 1970s and 80s, it didn't just kind of arise ex nihilo. There is this longer story about where this kind of different stream in Southern Baptist life came from, and it's a significant stream. It was always a minority stream, so I don't want to say that 70% of Southern Baptists embrace liberal theology. Far from it. But it was a substantial and it was an influential stream really up until groups like the CBF and the Alliance of Baptists and so on break off. And even still, yet past that, there's still significant influence, not only in select places in Baptist life, but also outside of Southern Baptist life. That tradition lives on, not only at educational institutions, but in prominent churches. I mean, just a quick search for CBF churches in any given Southern city, and you'll be able to see, okay, this tradition lives on, even if the name Poteet and many of his colleagues have been forgotten. And so on one hand, I think that's valuable just to be aware of and to kind of put that out there kind of on our radar, and hopefully, God willing, would spur a bit more to look at. I mean, there's so much more. I mean, I'm not quite writing in this book a full history of the liberal tradition that emerges, but I'm doing something like that. But you know, there might be someone, and I don't know if that would be me, but it might be someone that eventually wants to write kind of a full history of this tradition, not even necessarily moving forward chronologically all the way, although that could be done too, but kind of just delving in deeper within that first 40 to 50 years or so. So I think that's one thing. And then the other thing I think is just, again, going back to the point here about faith and culture, I think seeing the way that our culture, whichever culture we live in, how it shapes how we view the world, how we see what we believe. Again, not always in some deterministic way that says if you're born here and if you go to this school that you will therefore believe this or that. Human beings are more complex than that. But there is this significant influence, the way that an education, the way that our neighborhood, our family, all these sort of things do have a significant influence in just terms of what we believe and how we live out our faith. I'm seeing something very, very similar on the West Coast in this work, but I think it is very much true here in the Southern scene. And so I think seeing that, and then that allows hopefully a bit of introspection to just kind of, as we kind of discern and analyze this, so this is getting a bit more applicational, I hope that there's some wisdom to be gained there.
Yeah, that's good. Well, Paul, you're always a delight to have on the show. So if you're not a regular listener, you need to go listen to Paul's other stuff. We've done a couple things with him. You need to go get a copy of this book. And you need to send all your kids to OBU because you've got Paul there, you've got Matt Emerson, you've got Raphael Bello, you've got to get rid of Brandon Smith. I'm sorry, you know,
we're all here. Yeah.
Give Brandon a hard time if he listened this far. I know it's hard for him to focus for more than 5 minutes at a time. I'm still roasting him. Anyway, I appreciate you doing this, Paul. This is a lot of fun. I should have you on the podcast, I feel like, every month, given all the wealth of information that you have amassed over this period. So I'm always come away impressed, come away learned, and come away more genuine from learning from you. So thank you for what you do for us. And we encourage all of our listeners to check out your work. And everybody's listening, we thank you for tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you guys soon.
Thanks so much, Jordan.
Pretty soon. Hey, friends, this is just a periodic reminder that if you're a loyal listener of the London Lyceum, you are welcome to join our underground Slack group where we talk about things related to the London Lyceum, things related to theology and philosophy and history in general, and things that are more outside of that sphere as well. It's a lot of fun. We got a lot of pastors, a lot of academic students, a lot of just normal people. We hang out, we talk, and we have a good time, and we can have sort of off-the-grid discussions about things that matter. So if you're interested in joining, just find us on our website and just drop us a note, find the little contact button, send us an email, and let us know that you'd like to be added, and we'd be happy for you to join. It's a lot of fun, and we look forward to talking to you there.